Let's start out, if we could, and if you could give me a brief bio of yourself.
This is Michael Clare. I'm a professor of peace and world security studies at the Five College Consortium in Weston, Massachusetts. That's Amherst, Hampshire, Mount Holyoke, Smith College, and the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. And I'm also responsible for directing a program on peace and conflict studies at the five colleges. And for the past 20 or 30 years, I've been studying American military policy, the international arms trade, arms control and disarmament, and all those related issues. A lot of the time I've spent studying especially the trade in weapons, and written a number of books on that, one called American Arms Supermarket, a couple of them focused on the trade in guns and small arms, one called Lethal Commerce, and another one called Light Weapons and Civil Conflict. So I've been looking at arms trafficking and arms issues for a very long time, also issues of intervention and warfare. Wrote a book called Rogue States and Nuclear Outlaws, and another one called Low Intensity Conflict. So this is the backdrop. And in the past 5 years or so, I've become interested in the intersection between these traditional military and arms issues and problems of the environment and especially resources, competition over scarce or very valuable resources like oil, water, timber, diamonds, gold, copper, fisheries, anything that people view as being precious enough to fight over. And I've become convinced that conflict has always been about resources. That's widely accepted. But that with the end of the Cold War, I'm convinced that conflict over resources will more and more be a central feature in international peace and security affairs. And I express that in my new book called Resource Wars, The New Landscape of Global Conflict, which talks about a number of theaters of potential conflict: the Middle East, the Caspian Sea, the South China Sea area, river basins like the Nile and the Jordan, and timber areas, mineral areas, that these will be the central foci of armed conflict in the years ahead.
Currently, the U.S. is heavily involved in the Middle East, and specifically, amongst other areas, the Caspian Sea Basin. And one of our main allies there is Saudi Arabia. And I think a lot of Americans don't, at least from our corporate news, aren't getting a lot of information about the history of U.S. relations with Saudi Arabia, and I'm hoping that you can fill us in on that. My understanding is it started really at the end of World War II. Is that correct?
Yes, the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia really began during World War II, when the United States came to the conclusion that after the war was over, after World War II would be over, that the U.S. would become increasingly dependent on oil from the Middle East, that our domestic supplies would eventually run out, and that the only place in the world that would be able to supplant a decline, ultimate decline in Western Hemisphere supplies of oil would be the Persian Gulf area. And up until that time, the U.S. had very little interest in the area. We didn't even have diplomatic relations with Saudi Arabia until like 1943, and there were no links with the country. But during World War II, the State Department began to establish a relationship with Saudi Arabia in the interest of gaining access to its oil. And in fact, in 1945, President Franklin Roosevelt, who was very close to his own death, in February 1945, traveled to the Middle East and met with King Abdulaziz ibn Saud, the founder of the modern Saudi monarchy. And they reached an agreement, a gentleman's agreement, that the United States would protect the Saudi royal family against all of its various enemies in return for privileged access to Saudi oil. And that agreement really has been the basis for U.S. ties with Saudi Arabia up until the present. And a lot of military policies that we think of in other terms really hinge from that, like the Truman Doctrine and the Eisenhower Doctrine and the Carter Doctrine and the Nixon Doctrine. all entail, to some degree or another, U.S. role in protecting Saudi Arabia against potential enemies. And I would say right now that a lot of our involvement in the Persian Gulf stems from this basic policy.
Can you tell us, where does the Arabian American Oil Company fit into this?
During World War II, when the United States government came to the conclusion that it would be necessary for the U.S. to import a lot of oil from Saudi Arabia, the U.S. government actually began to plan for creation of a state-owned oil company that would manage all of the oil concessions in Saudi Arabia. This is based on the model of the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, which later became the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, and is the basis of British Petroleum, one of the largest companies today. That was originally a state-owned corporation. Winston Churchill was the person who helped set all that up, so that the British government would have control over access to Iranian oil. And the U.S. State Department actually began to lay the groundwork for establishing a similar company, which might have been called the American Arabian Oil Company or something like it, but that would be U.S. government-owned. And the oil companies balked at having the U.S. government get into the oil business, and they persuaded Roosevelt to back off from that scheme. But the idea of a joint American company that would manage the concessions was preserved in the establishment of Aramco, the Arabian American Oil Company, which was a kind of joint venture of the largest American oil companies of the time. And Aramco ran Saudi Arabian oil industry from the mid-1940s to the mid-1970s, when the concessions were nationalized by the Saudi government. But Aramco continues to operate as a management and a technical and a marketing arm of the Saudi National Oil Company.
Now, when Aramco was nationalized in 1976, what was the U.S. reaction to that? Because obviously in Iran, when oil facilities were nationalized there, it didn't go over too well.
Yeah. When Iran tried to nationalize its oil under Prime Minister Mossadegh, the CIA organized a coup d'etat and overthrew Mossadegh and replaced him with direct control by the Shah of Iran. And there was some consideration of that, I think, in Saudi Arabia. But I think the relationship in Saudi Arabia was different, in the sense that the Saudi royal family is so closely linked to the United States government that I think there were all kinds of understandings that took place at that time that there would be no fundamental change in the nature of the relationship, except that on paper, the Saudi government would have ownership of Aramco's holdings, but the basic situation where American oil companies manage a lot of the oil business in Saudi Arabia, that would continue, and that U.S. forces would remain tied to the Saudi government as they have during all of this time. So I don't think it presented the same sort of anxiety and alarm in Washington that you had in the 1950s with Mossadegh and Iran. I think something that did worry the U.S. government a lot was the possibility that the royal family would be overthrown by similar forces that overthrew the Shah of Iran in 1979-1980. There was a popular uprising led by Ayatollah Khomeini and other Islamic fundamentalists, overthrew the Shah and established the government that you now have in Iran. And the U.S. was terribly worried that a similar upheaval would occur in Saudi Arabia and that the royal family would be overthrown, thereby jeopardizing this special relationship that the U.S. has. And at that time, in 1981, when there was a uprising in Mecca against the royal family, which was put down with the help of the U.S., in the background anyway, President Reagan said at the time that we will not allow Saudi Arabia to become another Iran, meaning that the U.S. will not allow the royal family to be overthrown. And we've been beefing up our military presence in Saudi Arabia ever since. And of course, it's this military presence in Saudi Arabia and this close tie between the royal family and the U.S. government that underlies the terrorist conspiracy of Osama bin Laden and his associates.
Has the wealth and the power structure always pretty much been the same since the U.S. made its arrangements with Saudi Arabia back at the end of World War II, or has that shifted over time?
There certainly have been shifts in the relationship between Saudi Arabia and the United States. The Saudis have become, as their wealth has multiplied over and over and over again, the Saudi government has on occasion been more outspoken than it was in the past. There have been occasions even recently when members of the royal family have spoken out against America's close association with Israel. But the basic alignment, I think, hasn't changed. The U.S. continues to base its relations with Saudi Arabia on its special ties with the Saudi royal family, and its guarantee of protecting the royal family hasn't changed. And American troops are there now, still there, for this purpose. And I see no evidence that that's about to change.
How about internally? Has the Saudi government always been on par with its people, or has that deteriorated over time?
Well, that's an interesting question. There have been revolts in the past against the royal family. For example, while most of the Saudi population and the royal family itself are Sunni Muslims, there is a Shiite minority, especially in the northern part of Saudi Arabia near Kuwait and Iran, that end of the Persian Gulf, and that's where the oil is. So the Shiites have a big role to play in the oil industry, or in that part of Saudi Arabia, and they have revolted or had strikes, have resisted the royal family on a number of occasions, and that's been pretty much put down quite brutally by the Saudi Arabian National Guard, which is largely trained and equipped and armed and managed by U.S. defense contractors. So until very recently, the royal family has pretty much exercised totalitarian power. The change has occurred really since the Persian Gulf War of 1990-91. That was the turning point, because you had for the first time hundreds of thousands of American troops based in Saudi Arabia to participate in Operation Desert Storm. And this was deeply troubling to many devout Muslims who believe that Saudi Arabia is the Muslim Holy Land, because this is where Muhammad came from, where the holy shrines of Mecca and Medina are located. So for many Saudi Muslims, this was a sacrilege that so many Americans were based in Saudi Arabia. This was the point at which Osama bin Laden, who had been friendly to the U.S. because of its support of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, that's when he turned against the United States, as did those people who joined him in creating Al-Qaeda and supporting his terrorist network. And there are other Saudis who turned against the royal family at that time, who are not part of Osama's network, but provide a reservoir of support, of funding, of recruits. And what particularly galls these people is the fact that the U.S. is viewed as being very harsh towards the Muslim world, towards the Palestinians, to the Iraqi population, but does not object to Israeli use of force. And they think the U.S. is very hypocritical and biased against Muslims. And this feeling has grown to the point where today, I would say, the Saudi royal family is in deep trouble because of its very close association with the United States.
What did you think about the recent headlines, at least it was a headline in our paper here, about the Saudi government looking at asking the U.S. to leave?
This is part of the turmoil that the royal family now faces. And when we talk about the Saudi government, we're really talking about the princes, the royal princes who are in succession, the descendants of King Abdul Aziz ibn Saud, who I mentioned before, the king who met with Franklin Roosevelt. One of his sons, King Fahd, is the current leader of Saudi Arabia, but he's very ill. And so you have a third generation of princes, who none of which is the clear successor. And there are others in factions around these men. They're all men. And they vary in the degree to which they're willing to express hostility to the United States because of its ties with Israel. You know, some are more outspoken than others. So it's hard to say there's a clear position coming from the royal family. It's clearly they're divided, and there are these factions, and that's part of their problem. That's part of the instability, that there's no clear leadership at this time. But as to saying that the United States would be asked to leave, that I find hard to believe, because then there'll be no one to protect the royal family against possible internal rebellions, and I think they're very fearful of that. So you could say that the royal family is walking on a tightrope here. If it moves closer to the United States, it risks sparking a rebellion on the part of disgruntled Saudis. But if it moves away from the United States, it undermines its repressive capacity. I don't know where it's all going to go.
It seems like we've allied ourselves with two very fragile countries in the greater region, that of Saudi Arabia, and then on the other side over in Pakistan. Seems like things could fall apart in either of those two countries at any minute.
I think you're quite right. I wouldn't go so far to say any minute. I think over the long run, though, both Pakistan and Saudi Arabia are very unstable and are going to create a lot of problems for the United States.
I'm wondering if you could describe for us the relationship between the deposits, the larger deposits of oil of the countries in the Persian Gulf, and our military relationship with those countries, because it seems, after I cracked your book and looked at some of the charts, that Saudi Arabia has unquestionably got the largest deposit, and then you've got about four countries after that that have about, what, two-fifths to half of what Saudi Arabia has?
Right. After Saudi Arabia, the next biggest holders of oil are Kuwait, Iran, and Iraq, and the United Arab Emirates. Now, the U.S. already has a very tight relationship with Kuwait. American forces are permanently based there, and we've already gone to war twice on Kuwait's behalf. So it's clear that Kuwait is very closely tied to the United States. Iran is, and Iraq are two of the three countries named in President Bush's Axis of Evil. And I don't think that's accidental. I think that the fact that Iran and Iraq have moved away from the United States in past years is deeply troubling to American strategists, you know, and I do think they would like to overthrow one way or the other both of those governments and install friendly governments that would allow American oil companies to come in and develop their resources. And I do think that's part of the thinking behind the Axis of Evil speech.
And how about the United Arab Emirates?
The United Arab Emirates are also closely tied to the United States. Like Kuwait, there are American bases there or facilities. We sell them most of their weapons. There's all kinds of connections between the U.S. and the UAE. They really can't defend themselves. They rely on the United States. So of the five we mentioned, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE are closely aligned with the United States. Two, Iran and Iraq, are opposed, and these are two of the three countries that President Bush has singled out for American military pressure in the months and years ahead.
I found it interesting that the United States apparently has brokered a deal with the United Arab Emirates that in a couple years' time when they receive their new F-15, F-16s, that they will be the most advanced fighters on the planet, actually better than the U.S. versions of those planes.
Yes, I think that that's not insignificant in many ways as part of that deal. I think one of the reasons the U.S. was willing to sell them those advanced planes, as part of that deal, they're going to need new air bases to house those F-16s. They'll probably be built by the United States or in consultation with the United States. And as part of the deal, the U.S. will have access to use those new F-16 bases when they're built. So it's a way of piggybacking a new American base in the region through the guise of an arms transaction.
That's interesting, because a lot of times we'll focus on the military sales of the weapons themselves, but you bring up the facilities themselves are sound like they're big business too. Can you tell us a little bit about the companies that would be involved with that?
I'm not too sure about that. The big ones are Lockheed and Boeing. Those are the major makers of military aircraft, so they would certainly be involved. There are large engineering firms that historically have played a role in some of these operations, like Bechtel, I think, is one, which had close ties to the Reagan administration, based in San Francisco, because a lot of this is military construction is where the money is, rather than weapons sales. There's a number of companies that also provide military services, and one that's particularly interesting is the Vanel Corporation, which does the support work for the Saudi Arabian National Guard, and this was once owned by the Carlyle Group, which has very close ties to the Bush family and to other Reagan administration people. So there's a lot of links here between these companies and the current administration.
Yeah, the Carlyle Group seems to be pretty much a who's who of the past Reagan and Bush administrations.
Absolutely.
So let's jump over to the Caspian Sea region, which obviously is at the center of U.S. radar right now. And I'm wondering if you can paint us a picture of the different U.S. agreements, military exercises, and such. Your book, Resource Wars, starts out with a really intriguing illustration about a U.S. military operation in Kazakhstan.
Yes, Operation Centrasbat, which is an annual exercise involving American troops and forces from what the military call the stands, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan. The U.S. has annual training exercises with the military of those countries, and this goes back to 1997, I think, was the first one, and it reflects the Clinton administration's deep interest in the Caspian Sea.
And I believe there's been other similar operations there since then?
Well, actually, the Clinton administration was very interested in the Caspian area as a source of oil and natural gas for the United States and for its allies, and had a lot of activity, military missions going in all of the time to try to establish military-to-military relationships with the forces of that area. You know, training missions coming in all the time, military aid agreements of various kinds, training and arms transfers in some cases. I think it's very interesting, for example, that the 10th Mountain Division, which is now in Uzbekistan as part of the activities in Afghanistan, that this was not the first time that they had been in that area. They had participated in the second or third of the Centrasbat exercises. So they were already familiar with the region and in some cases had operated out of the bases that are now being used in Afghanistan to practice for operations in that region, clearly showing U.S. military interest in what happens in that area.
How about the military bases? At the time of the writing of your book, I don't believe there were any in that region, but haven't we secured some now?
We certainly have established what are being called temporary bases in Tajikistan and Uzbekistan, and the Defense Department has indicated that it intends to maintain a presence there for the indefinite future, all presumably tied to operations in Afghanistan. But most people who follow these developments believe that they'll turn into permanent bases, that the U.S. will always have a presence in the region, and that this presence is likely to be expanded in the years ahead as the Caspian becomes more crucial to our energy supply.
How about military agreements? I had heard that we recently were either negotiating or had negotiated a military agreement with Uzbekistan.
We already had agreements with these countries with the stands, certainly Kazakhstan, and I think Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, for military-to-military contacts. That is where high-level American generals would go over there and meet with their equivalent-ranked people for annual discussions about common interests, or they would come over to the Pentagon and meet with people here. So agreements were already in place. Clearly, they're now being expanded greatly, and you'll see now arms going into the area, a lot more training exercises, and as you say, bases being built up. I do think this is now going to be a major theater of operations for American forces and will remain so for far into the future.
I have to imagine that Russia would find America's efforts in that region to be fairly disturbing, having us going in and making different military agreements and having military operations basically at their back door. Must be fairly upsetting for them.
Oh, I think that this is deeply troubling to the Russian leadership. I think they're more concerned about this than they are about national missile defense. This is something that really threatens their geopolitical future. This is their part of the world. This was part of the Soviet Union. We forget that. It wasn't more than a decade or so ago when these countries were part of the USSR. It's as if the Russians were setting up bases in New Mexico and Arizona and Texas or something like that. That's the way, you know, you have to think about it from their point of view. And they consider this area very important to them strategically. And so I think the Russians are deeply troubled about the growing American presence. I think that they've kept their concerns pretty quiet because of this effort of Vladimir Putin, the president, to try to improve relations with the United States under the anti-terrorism campaign. I think he considers that a strategic necessity at a time when Russia is so weak and the United States is so powerful, and he wants the benefits of trade and contact with the West. But I do think that as time goes on, the Russian leadership is deeply concerned, is going to become more outspoken about the American presence in the area. I should say at the same time that Russia is no more than the United States. Russia is not a monolithic country. You have very powerful semi-privatized oil and gas interests like Lukoil and Gazprom that are the largest corporations in Russia today. And they're very interested in doing business with American oil companies in the Caspian. So you do have the leavening factor of oil company diplomacy is distinct from intergovernmental diplomacy.
How much is the oil company diplomacy shaping our current policy and, for that matter, Russia's current policy?
Oh, I think oil diplomacy is a very powerful factor in what's going on. And, you know, the oil companies have a common interest as oil companies. They all want to develop the Caspian and want the U.S. government to assist them in doing so. So you have a common interest, but they also have competing interests as well. The form that that takes is the pipeline issue that's becoming more and more controversial and central in all of this. The Caspian Basin is landlocked. The Caspian doesn't have any outlet to any oceans. So oil coming from that area has to travel by pipeline. And wherever you go from the Caspian, there are political difficulties. The easiest way to export oil from the Caspian region would be pipeline across Iran to the Persian Gulf, where you already have a well-established oil infrastructure. Now, needless to say, the U.S. government doesn't want the oil companies to move that way, and it's illegal under U.S. law for oil companies to operate in Iran. So I'm sure you have behind-the-scenes efforts by some of the large oil companies to calm down tensions with Iran in the hope that someday the relations will be good enough that they could put pipelines through Iran. That's one option. Other oil companies favor a route that will go from Baku in Azerbaijan across Georgia and then through Turkey. This is the one that the Clinton administration most favored, the Baku to Ceyhan route that goes through Tbilisi, the capital of Georgia. And some American companies are deeply involved in that effort. There's several other pipeline routes. One, which goes from Kazakhstan and is favored by Chevron, was deeply involved in that, goes through Russia to the Black Sea. And initially, the U.S. government was opposed to that because it travels through Russia. But in the end, the Bush administration has given its okay to that proposal. And then finally, there's another route that's especially controversial right now, and that's the one favored by Unocal Corporation for pipelines that would go from Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan across Afghanistan to Pakistan. And in trying to get approval for that pipeline, the CentGas proposal, Unocal negotiated with the Taliban up until just a year or two ago. Unocal was negotiating very closely with the Taliban government. And there are many people who believe that now that Afghanistan is more or less under U.S. control, that that pipeline route, which was suspended because of when Osama bin Laden found sanctuary in Afghanistan, that effort had to be put aside. But many people now suspect that Unocal will revive that project and that they will move to build a pipeline through Afghanistan.
When that project was put aside, did the Taliban back out on it, or was it something
like
it was Unocal?
No, what happened is the crucial events were the bombing of the U.S. embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam in August 1998, when the U.S. government concluded or claimed that those attacks were planned by Osama bin Laden, who was then known to be hiding in Afghanistan as a guest of the Taliban. The U.S. went to the Taliban government and said, turn him over to the U.S., and the Taliban refused. And at that point, the U.S. imposed sanctions, economic sanctions, on the Taliban, which made it impossible for Unocal or other U.S. companies to do business with the Taliban until such time as Osama bin Laden would be released. And, of course, we know that that never happened.
So the Taliban sounded like they were fairly cooperative then for the pipeline idea.
Oh, yes. The Taliban was very cooperative with the pipeline because they expected to make money on it. And the Taliban, for all of their piety, badly needed money and engaged in all kinds of illicit and licit activities. They were deeply involved in the illegal narcotics trade, for instance, and they saw the pipeline as a, you know, they were going to collect a toll on this operation. So they were very much in favor of it.
What other issues in the Caspian Sea Basin do you see as significant that aren't getting reported in the U.S. press?
Good question. Other aspects of this are the U.S. relationship with Turkey, which doesn't get the attention that it deserves, and particularly the Turkish behavior towards its Kurdish minority. Turkey has been engaged in a civil war with the Kurdish peoples who inhabit the southeastern corner of Turkey and have been fighting for greater autonomy, and the Turkish government has been very repressive and intolerant of the Kurds. There's been fighting, thousands of people have been killed, villages have been bombed, so there's a horrendous human rights record there. This matters because the pipeline that the U.S. wants to build from Baku through Tbilisi to Ceyhan on the Turkish Mediterranean coast would go right through the Kurdish region of Turkey. And I would imagine that if the Turkish uprising continues, which is certainly likely, this pipeline will become a target. And I think, therefore, that this will bind the U.S., if we go ahead with the pipeline, it will bind the U.S. to protect the pipeline. And I think we could see American troops guarding the pipeline. From one end to the other, there would be threats of terrorist bombings and sabotage, because the pipeline would pass through four or five areas of insurgency. In Azerbaijan, it would pass near Nagorno-Karabakh, the Armenian enclave that's revolted against Azerbaijan. In Georgia, it would pass south near South Ossetia, which, like Chechnya, is a Muslim area that's been in revolt against the central government. It'll pass Abkhazia, another Muslim area that's been in revolt against the central government in Georgia, and then, as I say, through the Kurdish regions of Turkey. All of these areas have seen a lot of insurgency in the past decade or so, and I do believe that the pipeline would come under constant threat, and I think that the U.S. will wind up being involved in protecting it. And I think this is the future of American military policy, really. And the other place to look for this kind of action, of course, is Colombia, where the Occidental Oil Company's pipeline, the Cano Limon oil pipeline from northeastern Colombia to the coast, goes right through guerrilla territory. It's been frequently sabotaged. And now, just last week, the U.S. government announced that the U.S. military will assist the Colombians in developing special brigades, special forces, to protect the pipeline against sabotage. So the U.S. will be involved now in Colombia, not only in the anti-drug war, but also in the pipeline protection operations. And I see this very much as the future for American troops in the Caspian region as well.
Yeah, it seems like a reoccurring theme, protecting oil resources, focusing on the anti-drug war, or what they call the anti-drug war, and now weaving terrorism into it. It seems like it's just this rubber stamp that you can apply pretty much to any country the world over.
Well, I do believe, as I argue in my book Resource Wars, that resource protection is becoming the dominant theme in American military policy. And we don't always hear about it that way. It could be described, as you say, as anti-terrorism or as anti-drug operations. But I believe that protecting oil is what lies behind a lot of it. It's also evident in U.S. role in the Philippines, for example, because the South China Sea is emerging as a major future source of energy, and especially as a crucial energy through route. That's how Japan gets its oil, by tanker through the South China Sea. And the U.S. is very eager to reestablish its bases in the Philippines. We had them at Clark Air Force Base and naval bases in the area until we were asked to leave by the government some 10 years ago. And now the U.S. is very eager to get back into the Philippines, and I think that's what's at least partially behind the new U.S. military effort now underway against Abu Sayyaf.
Do you think including North Korea in the axis of evil plays into that at all with the current administration?
I don't see how North Korea fits in except as a legitimizing factor. That is, to try to give some coherence to something that doesn't have any really... There are no links between Iran, Iraq, and North Korea the way there was between the Axis powers of World War II. Germany, Japan, and Italy had military relations with each other. You could say that they were an axis. That's not the case here. I do think that the primary targets are Iran and Iraq, as I indicated earlier, but I think if it had just been Iran and Iraq alone, that would have been viewed as about oil and also as being directed against the Islamic world. So I think North Korea was tacked on, but I don't think there's any other reason for it.
All right, let me give you a chance here to wrap up. What other things do you think is significant or would like to share with our listeners?
Well, I think that people need to look behind the sloganizing, you know, to think about what's really going on and what it means to us. Colombia being a good example, all we've heard about up until now is about the drug peril. And not to say that drugs aren't a serious problem, but it's clear that the Pentagon had other strategic interests in Colombia, namely oil. So I do think that this is a characteristic of American policy, that we don't like to admit that there are very material interests behind our policy. We have to bathe them often in a shroud of ideology or freedom or anti-terrorism, and certainly many people do believe in those concerns and that is part of it. I don't mean to diminish that. Terrorism is a threat, and Americans are right to worry about it and to take steps to protect themselves, but I don't think that that's all that's going on. I think if you probe beneath the slogans, you find these more traditional materialistic interests that drive American policy, especially the pursuit of oil. And I think people have to understand that the relationship between American policy and oil is bound to grow in the years ahead because our need for foreign oil is increasing very dramatically over the next few decades. Up until the 1970s, even into the 1980s, the United States derived most of its oil from domestic production, but America's domestic oil fields are now in long-term decline, and even the Arctic Wildlife Refuge, ANWR, is not going to fundamentally change that. ANWR would slow the decline of American production slightly for a few years, but it's a very small amount of oil compared to how much we consume on a daily basis. So more and more, the United States will become dependent on imported oil, and the places where it's going to come from are not stable regions. That's the fundamental reality of oil, is that it's mainly located, for better or for worse, in places that are unstable. The Persian Gulf, the Caspian, the Andes region of South America, and West Africa, another area where U.S. companies are increasing production, Angola, Nigeria, Chad, some of the other countries on the coast there. All of these places are very unstable, and I think that the more U.S. companies go into those areas, the more likely that American troops will follow. And I fear, this is my deep fear, that unless we address this problem of oil dependency head on, we're going to be fighting one resource war after another at great cost to the American public. So I guess in conclusion, I would say that I really think that as a people, we need to look at our petroleum addiction much more closely and ask ourselves whether it's truly worth it to risk the lives of our young men and women to protect the flow of oil so that we could drive gas guzzlers, essentially, or if, as a nation, we shouldn't commit ourselves to a policy of diminished oil dependence and develop renewable resources like wind and solar, so that we're not stuck in this trap of fighting one war after another for the inflow of oil.